tell your people, hey, revolution rising. Yeah, yeah. Proof. Yes. Watch out.
That's Mop Mop with Runaround featuring Fred Wesley. You remember Fred Wesley of the old James Brown band and Parliament Funkadelic of the 1960s and 70s. That's him, Fred Wesley on trombone, and poet, novelist, musician, and lecturer Anthony Joseph from Trinidad. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Free Your Mind Friday, May the 2nd. And yes, it's time to free your mind. Don't drag these thoughts that have been bothering you all week into your weekend. You need to free your mind today so that you could be pleasant to be around your friends and family over the weekend. So let's get started. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Let's hear what you have to say. Let's hear your take on the issues and events that have meaning to you and that you think require some added exploration and discussion and debate. From Berkeley, we start off with Harvey.
Hello, wonderful Utrice.
Hello, wonderful Harvey. How you doing?
Very good, very good. Well, I'm, like yourself, I'm an optimist because I believe optimists have better immune systems than pessimists. I believe that the optimism keeps us up and healthy, whereas pessimism actually creates a chemical reaction in the body that just works against you. So I think against all odds, it's actually healthier to be an optimist. And I'd like to talk about climate destabilization today. We've had, you know, during this past couple of weeks, we've had a lot of bad weather across America and a lot of destructive weather. So I'd like to talk about solar energy and the elegance of solar electricity. And photovoltaics is what it means is photo means light. Voltaic is electricity, so light to electricity. And I'd like to talk about the elegance of how it works. Did I ever explain to you how solar electricity works, Utrice?
I don't think so. I don't remember you saying that.
It's so beautifully simple. What it is that a silicon atom has a proton-neutron center, and then it has electrons in orbital shells around the proton-neutron center. And each orbital shell has two electrons, but on silicon, The outer shell has only one electron instead of a pair of electrons, and that makes it unstable. And there's enough power in a photon of light to knock off that outer electron on silicon, and it flows it's channeled into a circuit where it runs a circuit, and that is solar electricity. It's so simple.
I thought Really? After what you just said?
Yeah, it just knocks off that unstable outer electron on silicone. But another interesting material called titanium dioxide. Titanium dioxide is the white in white paint, and it too is photovoltaic. It has an outer electron on its atom that is a single electron. It's unpaired, and again, the light can knock off this outer electron, and it'll run a circuit. So the thing is that they can mate paint. Gary was speaking earlier about a paint. Yes, they can mate paint that produces electricity using titanium dioxide. And once again, once manufactured solar panels, regular silicon solar panels, they use no water over their lifetime. They make no noise. They have no moving parts to wear out. They create no emissions. And they actually, by covering a building with solar panels, you actually reduce heating and cooling costs inside the building because it creates another layer of insulation. And it also helps extend the lifetime of the roof. You know, often ultraviolet radiation deteriorates rooftops, so every 10 years they have to replace them. But if the roof is covered with solar panels, the lifetime on the roof lasts longer. So it actually saves the building owners a long, long time. And lastly, solar panels don't come with evacuation plans and warning sirens like nuclear power plants. So I say, especially because of climate destabilization, it's important to get solar as fast as we can. We have the technology. It's clean, it's wonderful, and it's simple. And I say, let's get solar.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You got us started today.
All right.
888-874-4888. Dallas, you're on the air, Sarah. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, Utrece. Greetings to you and greetings to the PRN listening audience, Utrece.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I will start off by wishing everyone an enjoyable weekend and hope they did something fun. And Harvey put me in mind of my chemistry lab classes because I had to go and pull out the books and dust them off. But it was good information. And to add on to what Harvey was stating with the chemistry and all of that with the solar, that is the same thing that would have to do with Earth's surface and all of this digging for oil. Because my personal thing is that I believe the oil acts as a lubricant to the Earth. And when you go down there and you're digging and you're extracting that oil from it, it creates that friction just like we have with our joints. So our joints have to glide and smooth on lubricants and on ligaments. And when it starts drying out and you have to get replacement knees and all of these things, it's because you have not taken care of the body properly. And that's what the Earth is. So they're going down further and further digging for oil, and you're seeing all of these earthquakes and sinkholes and all of these things. They need to leave that alone. But enough of the chemistry class. What I was going to touch on today, Utrece, foreign policy, is I was listening to what Secretary of State John Kerry, as well as with the President, on his overseas trip. And one of the hypocrisies and the things that really stood out to me with him is when John Kerry got up there and talking about the invasion, or the Russians are invading, and it's against policy, and was being very hypocritical and talking about, you know, the policies of going into another country and taking over. And I'm just saying to myself, I said, I can't believe this man is going to sit up here with a straight face and is going to try and tell this bold-faced lie, when that is exactly what the United States has done. That has always been their foreign policy, is to go in and invade other countries, take it over, call it bringing in democracy, freedom, and liberation for people at the cost of millions of lives, as they've done in Iraq. They're droning people all over in Yemen, in Somalia, and parts of East Africa, as well as on the African continent, and in Latin America, as well as parts in the Caribbean. That's been their mode. So whatever is going on with the Russians and the Ukraine, that is their impersonal business. They have a right to deal with it. No, Angela Merkel is at the White House, and they're trying to strategize because, once again, the United States, who did not keep their policy that Reagan made with Russia as far as NATO go, in not to encircle the Russians and their former republics as a condition of them giving up East Germany. And they should have known that Europeans don't keep their treaties, and they don't keep promises, as the Native American says, the white man speak with forked tongue. because every chance they get to backtrack on a deal and to go back, that is exactly what they have done. They have never kept any promises or any treaties that they have made. And that is what this is all about, is that they have decided to encircle Russia, to put in all of these, push NATO further and further. Now they're right at the people's back door. And Putin is standing up. He says, hell no. He said, this is where I'm going to stand my ground at this point, and y'all going to back off. And he has a right to do that. He has a right to protect his interests. Like, the United States is going all over, all into Asia. This is not even close. We're not even sharing borders with none of these countries all the way out in Asia that they are going to stake their claim and calling this is a part of the U.S. defense strategy, and we have to protect ourselves. How are you protecting yourself when you're not even sharing borders with Iraq, Afghanistan, or none of these countries, but you're out there doing these things? And that is what they have been selling to people in the media in order to get you to buy it and go along with bad foreign policies. And what people might need to read, they might need to go back and read Edward Bernays' book, Propaganda, that was written way back in the 20s, so they could get an understanding as to what it is that's going on, because the media, the fourth branch of this government, have a very good way of manipulating information and you to get you to go along with things that's going to put you in danger, because all of these things that this United States is doing as a part of their foreign policy is going to backfire on us, the average citizen, that we have to go out here, you have to travel, you have to do things. It's going to backfire on us. This is not good business, and it's about time we wake the heck on up and stop, you know, whatever the heck we are doing, and contact your congresspeople and contact Congress, because they are treading into very, very dangerous grounds is where they are going right now.
Well, they've always done that. The government, particularly this particular administration, and I say this particular administration because it, President Obama, as candidate Obama, had projected an entirely different attitude toward foreign policy, as did John Kerry. In fact, one of the things I did, I don't know if you remember some time ago, I played a tape of a statement being made, a very passionate statement about the war.
Yeah.
And only at the very end did I say that that person speaking against the war and against U.S. military aggression and the U.S. role in creating so much hardship through warfare in other parts of the world, that person was John Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
The same John Kerry now who is the ambassador of open and total aggression and passive aggression as well, but aggression nonetheless. So the administration essentially has conformed to the exact opposite of what it is they articulated, both individually, Kerry was supposed to be a peace guy, and collectively as a government. The Obama administration has continued this program of aggression and imperialism all over the world. We still have a bunch of wars going. We have a lot of wars going, despite the fact that it's not being covered that way. And it doesn't look like there's going to be any commitment to change. The United States has not come to terms with the idea yet that it may gain a heck of a lot more by promoting peace instead of being aggressive and joining in aggression and open warfare in other parts of the world. At some point, it's going to escalate, and the United States will be the target of aggression by others, because
all of them will come together on mutuals, because
there's
all
only so much people could take, you know. And when you have, for example, what is going on in Ukraine and with Russia, the United States still has this mentality that it has to dominate the entire world. The entire planet has to be under its control. And for that, the domestic policies that we should be experiencing some degree of movement on in a positive way are subsumed to the business of warfare and aggression. We have to maintain soldiers, and tax dollars are going there. You have to maintain a strong defense. You have to maintain a well-equipped military. All that money, all of that Department of Defense money that could be going to really improving the quality of life for the vast majority of Americans here at home. These things will come to a head at some point, and people will rebel, both domestically and internationally. People are going to become very, very agitated with this continued practice of lying, because in order to keep these programs going, you have to lie to people and tell them it's about democracy here. You have to lie to people there, too, and tell them, we're killing you for your own good. Yeah. But your point is well taken. Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for calling. From New York, Jay, you're on the air.
Nutrice, I would just like to first wish you a happy weekend. I've enjoyed your program this week immensely. And, you know, just two quick questions. Number one, if I could maybe get your take on this guy, Zbigniew Brzezinski, because I was having a brief discussion with a gentleman today earlier, you know, in my vehicle, and he was saying something to me about that Brzezinski was the father of Al-Qaeda in a sense that he created Al-Qaeda association with America with the war in Afghanistan with the Russians. And I know a little bit about it, but I don't really know too much about it in detail because I noticed him and now one of his sons is constantly on Morning Joe pushing this whole Ukraine thing. And I'm totally against the Ukraine thing. I think it's kind of hypocritical based on the fact that we can invade Iraq and Libya and other places which are 1,000 miles away from us. But here it is, Ukraine, which is basically next to Russia, they can't deal with that situation. I mean, that to me just don't sound right. But I was wondering maybe if you could give me a little idea on what the guy was saying was correct.
There was an interview, I think, with, I can't remember, Alexander Coburn, I think, some time, about a year or so ago, in which Brzezinski talked about working on a plan in conjunction with President Carter to create the Mujahideen as a countervailing force in the Arab states that where they expected a tremendous backlash against the United States. I don't recall very much more than that, but it's worth looking at.
Okay.
Alexander Coburn, I remembered, had done an interview with Zbigniew Brzezinski about that.
Okay, I'll look into that. Also, the second thing was this situation with the NBA. I truly enjoy your analysis, and I think it put into place what will go forward. I don't believe, this is just my personal belief, that the owners will forget the position that the players put them in, and there will be a form of payback when this new collective bargaining agreement is over. I don't think that the NBA players really gained anything by making them get rid of Mr. Sterling. But the funny thing to me is that one of the owners, I think his name is DeVoice, has been very, very outspoken and critical of gays. And it just seems to me is, well, as big and powerful as the gay lobby is, why isn't that they haven't put the same type of pressure on that owner in the manner in which they put against Mr. Sterling? It just seems a little hypocritical to me. Or maybe if they get away with what they're doing to Sterling, which my prediction is he will fight this because he's a litigator and he loves to litigate, if they could do that to him, then maybe they will go against Mr. DeVoice, I think. I think it is when some person in the gay community stands up and make an outrage on it. And, you know, we'll see what happens with that. But then again, they don't want to address the situation with the word Redskins, with the Washington Redskins in the NFL. So I think it's all just absolute utter nonsense on all parties involved. But in the end, I think the players will suffer dearly for this form of embarrassment in making these gentlemen do the right thing. And like you said, they didn't even do it the right way.
You're on point with that, no question. And that was exactly where I was going with it. That this, you know, you don't put your nose where it doesn't belong. And the players should have just receded and concentrated on the idea of, you know, promoting the playoffs and working hard and making the playoffs the most memorable playoffs in history. Say those kinds of things, but don't get involved in it. This is an institution that should, and it has the resources to correct itself. It has the resources to figure a way out. That's not their job. Their job is to just concentrate on playing great basketball. That's it.
Okay, but you, Treach, I agree with everything that you just said. And the thing that I would like to ask you this, and I know you'll speak truth to power, is I have only heard two commentators speak in the manner in which you are talking about this situation is. And these are two brothers, the brother that you had on yesterday, Bomani Jones, and somebody who kind of surprised me by his analysis on it. Maybe you could read his piece on ESPN and get your take, really, of it. Jason Whitlock. Those are the only two people that I've heard or seen have any form of analysis in this regard, in which direction you have taken this. And you have a beautiful weekend, sister.
Thank you very much, Jay. Thanks for your call. And your very insightful analysis there with respect to the players leaving themselves open now for future action by the owners for basically embarrassing them and participating in protecting management. Their job is to just observe and say absolutely nothing. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for your call. From Maryland, Green.
Hello, Eustrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
The same as always. I refuse to complain. Look, Eustrice, you've mentioned a lot about the lack of race men. And, of course, that would include race women, too. But I think that we're desiring the product and ignoring the process. People become race people because of their experiences and things that become plain to them. And in the society we have now, I mean, I'm talking about with black folks, everything is thrown at us, or we throw everything at each other to dilute that kind of feeling in our people. For example, most of those who speak to us or supposedly speak for us can't seem to divorce the words Spanish, Latino, or Hispanic to the word black when talking about a problem that black people have. Now, I'm sure that, you know, well, we know that other groups have their problems. And I really took Daco to heart that time when she mentioned the thing about compassion. And we should always have compassion, but we need to concentrate on our problems. Because once we're straight, we can reach out to other people. And the clip that you played about that you played with Muhammad Ali.
Yes.
He even went so far as to tell white folk, "You are my enemy, not the Viet Cong."
Well, so, actually, he was responding to one particular guy who had asked him and challenged him about what is it
but
that
he
you
became a race man because of his affiliation with the Nation of Islam. And the Nation of Islam teaches its members that you have to do a black thing. You have to do a black economic thing, a black political thing, and a black social thing. And just like your fellow countryman, Kwame Ture, you know, he often spoke about issues that we might have compassion for, but they're just not our fight. Because we have to concentrate on a black thing.
I'm listening.
Well, to me, that's basically it. If you want to have race, men and women, we have to stop teaching our young people that, no, you have to go along to get along, that you don't need to be concerned about other people. You take care of yourself. I got mine. You get yours. And concentrating so much on or diluting our focus by including the problems that, you know, everybody on the planet has. And in actuality, they're not concerned about us, and they show that all the time. According to the rules of white supremacy, we're on the bottom. We're supposed to be on the bottom. And we play along with those things, I mean, with that idea. I would say just about everyone in the world is a white supremacist to some degree. I even consider myself to be a white supremacist because this is what I was taught from the womb. The difference is I'm a recovering white supremacist. And there are a lot of us who are in recovery and some who just have the disease full blown. So that's basically what I'm saying. We're ignoring the process. We retard the ability for our people to develop in the race, men or women, by, you know, always diluting the focus.
Well, thank you. Let's see how that resonates with others today. Thank you so much for your contribution. Thank you. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Eutrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking. I wanted to kind of do a recap of some things that happened this week and also make some observations, I guess. I guess I'm not that much of an optimist as much as Sarah and Harvey and people like that because, well, I guess I'm a little jaded, but I'll tell you why. Well, first of all, let's start off with this situation with the Los Angeles Clippers. I totally agree with most of the things that you said, especially about the players having an onus put on them to demonstrate some kind of rebellion or something like that. I think that part of it is ridiculous. I want to start off with where this conversation that was recorded, how it got released, and what I found out about it. The major point that got her to release that to DMZ, and who knows how much money she got for it, but she obviously on the conversation is baiting him and asking him questions to get him to say things because she already knows who she's dealing with, right?
Now, you're talking about the young lady referred to as V. Stiviano.
Yes.
Okay.
She's obviously baiting him. Now, I'm not excusing him being a racist or anything. I'm just saying that because there's no excuse for the things he said, but she is baiting him because she knows what she's going to get. Now, when she decided to release it, the reason why is because the wife of Mr. Sterling, and I have no idea whether they're still together or what the dynamic is or if they're separated, but the wife has filed a lawsuit against Ms. Stiviano.
Yes.
She filed it in March, and the lawsuit claims, among other things, that Ms. Stiviano is taking community property when she's accepting gifts from Mr. Sterling. In a way, I believe that's true, but it's alleging that it's about $2.5 million so far, and $1.8 million of it is towards a duplex that Mr. Sterling purchased for her. So the girlfriend, V. Steviano, who changed her name, by the way, to an Italian name from a Hispanic name back in 2010, threatened that if you do this lawsuit against me, I'm going to release this tape. So apparently she already had the tape and had it waiting. I don't know when it was recorded. So this is her motivation behind it. It's she's protecting her interests, I guess, and it's out of vengeance. So I'm looking at the NBA because I've always been a basketball fan myself, and I played basketball in high school a couple of years, and I've always loved the game. I've just never been a rabid fan to where I will do anything to see basketball, except it on any conditions and do all this. So what I believe is that the people have the power to demonstrate that this man's behavior and his things he's saying are unacceptable by withholding your money from him. Okay, because there's a lot of power in money, even though he is a billionaire, I mean. But so I believe, number one, that the NBA did what they had to do, not because they were just morally outraged and Commissioner Silver was just so upset about it. They did it because of money, because we're talking big business here. The playoffs is, especially this year, I mean, this is the time where they make most of their money. Mm-hmm. And when he saw sponsors falling off like flies, you know, like dead flies, what he said was, well, you got to stop the bleeding here, because this is, we're talking billions of dollars for the NBA, you know. So this is why they did it. And I don't think it's any moral stand. I think it's all about money.
Absolutely.
And so I'm looking at that, and I'm looking at the game, right, the other day. I did watch the Clippers game following that and the one yesterday, and I also have been watching the Eastern Conference playoffs as well. And I'm looking at all these people, thousands upon thousands of people that are buying the team's gear, whether it's Toronto or Brooklyn or whoever. They're buying their gear. They're paying for these tickets. I mean, how much money is this? And look at all these people. You can get 20, 30, 40,000, sometimes 50,000. I mean, one Toronto game, there was people standing outside watching on a in the cold, watching it on a big screen. I mean, I'm saying if we could get just half of this amount of people to come out on an issue that really does affect their life instead of this stuff that really has no effect in your life, we would be in pretty good shape. I mean, this is a lot of people that participate in this. So I think it's really warped. It's like we talked before about how people in our culture, in this country, they don't really – I think I'm starting to get a better understanding of why there's not enough activism and not enough people out there. It's not just because – they want to be entertained and they just want to forget about their problems. That's part of it. But the other thing is, in this country, the mentality's been warped to make everybody be more of an individual than in other countries. And it's like a one-man stand thing. Let him take care of it. He'll do it. And I could give a ton of examples. I'll give one or two. One was the Elgin Baylor that you mentioned this week. Mm-hmm. Nobody stood behind him when he was trying to point out that this Sterling was a racist.
That's right.
Like not even players and ex-players from the NBA. So it's like, oh, well, he'll take care of it. He'll do it. And I think that, you know, there's all kinds of revolts going on around the world right now. And most Americans don't even know anything about it. I mean, there's revolts going on in Brazil, Turkey, Egypt. Those are probably the most prominent, but also countries in South America. People are in other countries look at things differently than people here. It's that go-it-alone mentality. You get yours, I'll get mine. I won't worry about your problems, you won't worry about mine. But yet, every time something like this happens with Sterling, then we expect people to jump into another gear and start to jump on board with things. Now, I've talked also to you before about why people like these salacious situations, these programs and things where people are fighting and backstabbing each other and doing all these things. And I think it relates to that as well. It relates to the fact that we're all taught in this country from birth that you are an island, basically. You do what you have to do for yourself. Mm-hmm. And don't worry about anybody else. And I think that's the difference between the way people are indoctrinated in this country as opposed to other countries. And the last thing I wanted to point out is that when do you think, well, it's actually a question, I guess, when do you think, or do you think it'll ever happen that things will get so bad in this country maybe, or something will happen to the point where people will try to shake this individualistic approach we have to everything? I mean, you can see it when it comes to health care. You can see it when it comes to anything that's supposed to help, you know, the society as a whole. We have this mentality that that's your responsibility. Do you think there's any way that we're ever going to get past that type of mentality?
But not without extraordinary insight, insightful leadership from the dominant cultures. This is one of the things I talk about when we talk about racism. Racism is work. You have to work against it.
Right.
In this situation, let's say with the NBA, people are more offended then they see a need to be combative about. This is a fight. This is a fight. The fight is, of course, transmuted now because we have essentially a situation. It's occasioned by the revelation between two people who have a very strange relationship. But what we confront is the battle, the two psychological things that are battling for space and domination in all of our minds. Number one, this business you talked about, individualism, you know, the notion of rugged individualism, that is a concept that has worked for the dominant culture. It comes smack up against the exact opposite concept of the people who are dominated. Everybody from the dominated class, whether it's Native Americans, African Americans, Latinos, whoever, come from cultures that are communal in nature.
Right, exactly.
So we don't see things very, very much the same. So this push and pull, this is very important. If you are of the dominant culture, you would tend to think in terms of I, me, and my. If you come from other cultures, you tend to think of us as a group, because that has been the culture of the dominated classes.
That's
the essential battle.
There's going to come a point when, I mean, are we going to still be, when we have no more fresh water to drink, when we have no more food, when we have no more, the air is barely breathable, are we still going to be thinking like, you know,
yes,
well, you
because
get yours, I'll get mine.
It is still a great comfort, even as you suffer. Okay, this is going to sound bizarre, but even though you suffer, it is supposed to be of great comfort to you that you're better than somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's kept this whole thing going. People are unwilling to understand that they share in the grief. They actually are also targeted. They actually are also being denied. But they hold on to the idea more so that they nonetheless are members of a privileged class, and that makes them, that is of greater comfort to them than to acknowledge the fact that they share more in common with the people who are suffering. It's a very, very deep psychological thing.
It's very
for people to make. Look, I know a person who is, you know, considered a very top flight or better than most real estate agent. Mm-hmm. All right? She happens to be Jewish, and reached the point, actually, I got a call one day from a supermarket, and it was her. She was in great distress because she had been arrested. And I said, well, what's going on? She said, I'm so embarrassed to say, but the only person I could think of calling was you. I need your help. So I went to figure out what's going on. It turns out, of course, the market had, you know, experienced a catastrophe here in Florida, and business went really terrible. She was caught stealing food. All right?
Yeah.
Now, you have to understand this. Look,
yeah.
She was caught stealing. She had gotten quite a few things, and she was walking out of the store, and she got caught.
Right.
Now, but she could not bring herself to make her case with the manager to say, look, I'm in real distress.
Mm-hmm.
He would have listened to her,
right,
and he would have been sympathetic, I think. But she was in a really awful state when I got there. So that's when I found out what this is all about. She was arrested because she was stealing food. She had no money.
And she couldn't bring it to herself to
plead her case of poverty.
Right.
So she felt I would have been better suited to do. You understand? So that tells you, that's the story right there.
Well, we saw the same thing, I think, when the Occupy movement broke out. Not only did we have young whites there who were college educated and saw that the system doesn't give a dang about them either. I mean, they can't find jobs. They're in debt. And also, not only that, when the police came out to break it all up, they didn't treat them any different than they would a black guy in South Central LA. You know what I mean? So I think that's a shock to a lot of people. You know,
that's what I mean. The psychological notion was in her head, and I couldn't, you know, pile this on top. I just had to understand it and note it. But the idea that it was in her mind, and it's a vestige of racism, actually, but the idea that even in her circumstances, which are very real, I mean, you're in handcuffs and you're sitting there in the manager's office, she could not bring herself to say to the manager that she had no money and she was hungry and she had two dogs and they were hungry and she just couldn't see any other way of eating rather than taking. I ended up, but the point I'm making is, what would make her think that except that this notion of superiority had been so deeply ingrained in her head that even to her own peril, you know, she just could not cross that line. She just wouldn't cross that line, psychologically conditioned to think that of her superiority.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So thanks so much for calling. We've had a good conversation today.
Right. Thank you, Patrice. You have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
From Queens, Richard, you're on the air.
Greetings.
Thank you, Richard. Same to you.
Hello?
Yes, I'm hearing you.
How are you, my sister?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
The Ella is just here listening. I tune in late, but I just want to try and make a little contribution. And I want you to know that you are one of my heroes. You always were and you always will be.
Oh, that's so gracious of you to say, and I thank you for it.
And
thank
I pray so that the God of our ancestors will continue to bless you and keep you always.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I really do appreciate
thank you.
It.
Now, my sister, I'm of the opinion a long time ago that this country is suffering from a serious virus that is more deadly than the HIV/AIDS virus. And I believe it is called racism and its twin white supremacy. And what this, I'm getting kind of tired of our people getting up in arms. Every time these racists express what is in their minds, we get up in arms. And I was listening to one of your callers, it's probably not the last one, maybe the one before, as to motivation as to why this this young woman would expose the recordings of the remarks that were made by her master. And I think back in time, when I had hope that the wives of these slave masters that raped and sodomized our women and ancestral women and young boys and men and so forth, I just somehow hope that they had took out a lawsuit against their husband for what they were doing to African people. You understand me? So what I think many of our people are missing the big picture, and you probably dealt with it already. But my mother always said to us as children that sometimes out of evil can come some good. And I hope that we don't miss the picture of talking about why this woman did what she did and this guy's a racist. I already know that he's a racist based upon his background. And I believe that most of those owners of these clubs, these athletic, these sports things, I believe that most of them are, if not all of them. They are in a clique, a class by themselves. What I'm concerned about is for all these years, blacks have become the mainstay of these teams. They are bringing in untold billions and trillions of dollars into the pockets of these leeches, these parasites. They are making them richer and richer and richer. And still, they look at the blacks who are doing, the Africans who are doing this for them, as if they're marginalized, they're dehumanized. And they not for one moment to stop and think as to who is bringing in this money for them. When you think of from the music industry to the athletic, to sports, to religion, to academia, you name it in this country, Africans have been at the bottom of the ladder and catching hell. And I wonder when is it this country going to finally wake up and say, enough is enough. We have done enough to Africans in this country. When are they going to wake up? So I would hope that out of this evil here, we can have some teams. We can have some African, and I'm not talking about the Oprah types and so, because I have yet to hear an African stand up in this country and say we want to own a team outright. Africans pooling their resources together. We have people here with money, Sister Utrees. And as I say again, I'm attacking the showpiece type of the Oprahs and the Jay-Z and so forth. I'm talking more conscious Africans pulling their resources together and without collaborating with groups where they become a minority owner. I want to see Africans own these things outright. And we're always compromising. Why are we always compromising? I don't hear them saying that they want to have the teams open up. Also, it's about time the NBA and all these other team groups open up. We have to force them. We have to demand that they open up this team, because it's about time Africans get the rightful share of what is going on in this place. It is ungodly. Sister Nutris, what is that? I can't figure it out. You know, I was reading something a moment ago that the Honorable Marcus Garvey said. And Mr. Garvey said, and I quote, if you are strong, you have justice on your side. He said, if you are weak, you are at the mercy of the dispenser of justice. He said, there is no justice but strength. There is no justice but power. And if you have sense and you want justice, get power. Get it quick, get it anyhow, unquote. And I might add to that, Malcolm X well said, by any means necessary. These folks don't intend to give up anything to our people. They continue are using, abusing, marginalizing, robbing, and I get so upset sometimes it just to see what is happening to our people. When is it going to change? When are we going to make it change? My sister, I don't know. I'm at my wit's end. And I'm an old guy getting ready to go through the pearly gates. And I was hoping that before I go through the pearly gates, I would see some changes, positive, conscious changes, so that when I go and I see Brother Marcus and Malcolm and killed all those people, and they ask me about what's been going on down there, I could give them some good words. But I don't see it. I don't see it. So my sister, that is my little contribution.
Well, it was very profound and very applicable to the experience today. Most people I know are asking the same kinds of questions. What does it take to get people to move in a direction other than the direction they're moving in now? What would it take to reverse the process? What would it take to get folks mobilized in their own interests and in their own behalf? This is very important. I talked about the fact that, you know, the same civil rights leaders who are so happy to be in the camera's eye, when a report was issued that said New York City and New York State is the most segregated state in the United States when it comes to schools. And nobody was there. It's not sexy enough. These are the things that they're calculating now. Do we become involved in issues, you know, that would generate press coverage and the media? And would we get to, you know, rub shoulders with the hobnobs and with the right people? They're no longer interested in the grimy work that has to be done, and it's very unattractive, it's very unsexy, it's very hard work. And that is why I say that unless people are really prepared to do that kind of work, they should just shut up and get out of the way, because that is the work that is required. Very hard, grimy, unattractive work that would be very frustrating many times, but that is what is required. And we don't have too many takers in that realm. They're not showing up in impressive numbers to do that kind of work. You see? So I understand your frustration, and I share it. But still, I can't be so hopeless, because I do see there are people who are in their own ways doing that kind of work, not necessarily enough. Then by no means a large number of people, but there are people still hanging in there doing that kind of work. I know that because I'm familiar with them. So we can only hope that by example, they impress others to get involved as well at that level. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. Thank you. Well, this was a very interesting session today. And I appreciate the passion, by the way. It's a very good thing. And that's what this program is about, capturing real feeling and allowing people to express what it is at their heart, you know, what it is that they're feeling and their observations. That's a very important way to facilitate discussion, meaningful discussion, because that is what is necessary as a prerequisite to creating meaningful change. We've been spending centuries talking at or over each other, but not to each other. And for many, they would rather not hear the unvarnished truth, and that is an impediment to progress. We have to have people speak the truth of what they know. Whether we agree or disagree, I mean, that's a whole different ballgame. But there's no reason to deny the fact that this is the real feeling of many, many people. And I'm delighted that we have this venue to facilitate that level of discussion and to embrace it for what it is. It is a reflection of very, very serious meaning. Thank you so much. Stay tuned. Keep right here. Wake Up Call with Richard Martin is next. I want to thank you for the pleasure and for the absolute privilege of your company. Have a good weekend.